stay tuned for The Lynn Show. All summer, I have been rebroadcasting some of the most remarkable interviews I've done over the last 3 years. These interviews are all of people for whom the art to which they have given their life didn't seem a conscious or even intentional choice. It seemed to come to them or through them. And these stories are all extraordinary. This month, I have played interviews with musicians, all of whom discovered their music by the time they were 3 years old. Today's interview is of Michelle Brauerman, who is not only an extraordinary musician and pretty much can do whatever can be done with music, but she is, for me, a very, very special friend. This interview includes not only the things I talk about with most people, but because it was the very first interview I did, it's the prototype. So sit back and get ready to hear not only an interview with an extraordinary musician, but a sensitive, philosophical human being, not to mention some terrific music. So hang on. Here come the show. You and me, and how all of us have learned to keep some parts of ourselves hidden, and not only hidden from other people, but hidden from ourselves. If you've been listening, you know, because I talk about this at the beginning of every show, that I believe, based a lot on my 30 years of experience as a psychotherapist and quite a lot on my experience as a human being and a friend and family member of other human beings, that part of what happens in childhood, part of what's supposed to happen in childhood, is that we're supposed to receive encouragement for all of who we are. But in order to socialize us, and sometimes in response to a parent's own fears, inadequacies, feelings of insecurity, frights, and all kinds of things, instead of encouraging the full expression of who we are discouraged from expressing certain aspects of ourselves and encouraged to highlight, demonstrate, present other aspects of ourselves. And so, because all of us as small children want only to please those giants on whom our life depends, we figure out a way to be either what they tell us we are, what they tell us we need to be, what we decide based on our experience of the circumstances of our life, what we decide we have to be or had better not be. And then we construct what I call a cover story. Very like what spies do, only the cover story that spies present in order to be safe, not to be discovered, they know it's a cover story. We create this cover story, and then over time, our unconscious convinces us that this cover story is all there is to us. And that is simply not the truth. Again, in my experience, what I see is that those qualities which didn't fit in the cover story, they get submerged, and I talk about them as being put undercover. Okay, so we do whatever it is that is necessary to survive in the best way that's possible through our childhood. We make the correct decisions based on the experience that we have. However, later in life, it may very well be necessary for us to use some of those things which we have hidden undercover. And I've talked at length about this in all of the shows, about the kinds of things that we have hidden undercover which become, well, I want to say necessary. Lots of people live without them, so obviously it's not necessary. But necessary for living the very best life that we possibly can. Living the life that would have been possible for us had we not been discouraged from expressing whatever it is we had to hide. And people have to hide everything. I had a client once whose parents told her that joy was the devil's tool and she had better not experience it. I've had lots of clients, and I know lots of people who submerge their capacity to be angry or to experience hurt. They go along, you know those people, you ask them how they are, and they are fine. They are always fine. Well, of course, that's insane. Nobody is always fine. And yet, we all know these people. And it's not just the knee-jerk, how are you, I'm fine, but they present it as though that's the only option. And for them, sometimes it really is the only option, to believe they are always fine, never to demonstrate, never even to know that they are sad or hurt. Well, those feelings, those qualities, those capacities that we have put underground, they actually don't go away. They're there. They're just hidden from us. And not only do we suffer from the loss of them, the capacity to experience joy, that's an obvious one, but the capacity to experience assertiveness or anger or hurt. But not only do we suffer from the loss of that, not being able to use it, but it takes energy to suppress it. So a certain amount of our energy is not available to us. Okay, this show is about making that point, telling you, and if you listen to the show, you hear it over and over again, that this is what I believe, and that I hope that you will hear me and begin to just consider the possibility that there are aspects of yourself which you don't have access to, and to wonder what they are, to wonder how your life might be different if you had them. And then, having discovered them, that's not the end of the process. I'm so sorry. It's not so simple as, oh my gosh, right, joy. I ought to be able to experience joy. Woohoo, joy. No. All the taboos against not experience it continue to live in our chemistry. And I will continue to talk about how you begin to access them in a safe way, how to alter brain chemistry, for example. But the other thing that I do in my show is I interview writers and artists, people who make their living with an art. And I do that because in order to do that in our culture, in order to define yourself as an artist in our culture, it has to be who you really are. Because this is not a culture that really supports art and artists. And so it has to be compelling. You have to have had no choice. And when you listen to the artists that I interview, you hear it. You hear what we therapists call congruence. That is, that there's no separation between who I am and what I present. And so at least in the area of their work, these people are congruent, what I am hoping you and I will all be aiming for. And in this summer, I have been rebroadcasting some of my most remarkable, not all, but some of the most remarkable interviews that I've done over the 3 years that I'm doing this. This is the last in that series. I'm going to start doing new shows next week. And it is appropriate for this to be the last one in this series because this is the very first interview that I did. Not surprisingly, I chose a very close friend to do this interview with. And I didn't only choose her because she's my close friend, but because she demonstrates all of the things that I want you to hear. Not only the extraordinary compulsion to be and do what she does. If you've been listening this month, all of the musicians that I have, whose interviews I've played, have found their music by the time they were three, and that is equally true of Michelle Brauerman. But Michelle is just extraordinary. I mean, there's virtually nothing you can do with music that Michelle doesn't do. She writes, she sings, she accompanies, she produces, she directs, she arranges, she she teaches, she writes in virtually every form you can think of, and her commitment to her work is unshakable. This interview is slightly different from the other interviews that I did because this is the prototype. This is where I learned what I wanted to do. So, in addition to this interview, which is so engaging, so thoughtful, so powerful for me, really, and I'm sure it will be for you, I'm playing four songs from Michelle's CD. They are, like Michelle, extraordinary. These are her compositions, and she is also singing and playing, and she arranged it and produced it. So I'm going to play two songs and then the interview and then two more songs. And the first two songs, well, the first song is My Favorite Year, which is not only a favorite of everybody who hears it, but a favorite of Michael Feinstein, and you can hear it on his album. And the second song is Old Love, which always makes me cry in a happy way. So, without any further talk from me, here is My Favorite Year, followed by Old Love, followed by my interview with Michelle.
wandering in my mind. You were right, and I was blind. But that was long ago. Now, do I ever cross your mind? You go after all the loves I've lived through all these years. I had to go so far without you. Now it's clear you were my favorite love. That was my favorite year when we were young forever yesterday. Fools and little children run away. If we could go back there, would we stay? It's clear you were my favorite love. That was my favorite year. You were my favorite love. That was my favorite.
Telephone rang. She was sweeping the kitchen floor. A voice from the past said, "Are you Anna Jean? Did you live in Greenville in 1924? Do you remember the first boy you kissed out beside the old gym?" She said, "You always remember your very first beau." And he said, "Were you talking to him?" It was old love, so long ago, and yet, through the time and the tears and the passage of years, some things a heart won't forget. Her heart skipped a beat when he said, "Can we meet? There's something you might like to see. It's a picture in glass of a second grade class. I'm sitting there smiling with you next to me." She turned her eyes to the old grand piano where the picture stood in its place. It was old, it was worn, it was faded and torn. She knew the smile on that face. It was old love, so long ago, and yet, through the time and the tears and the passage of years, some things a heart won't forget. They met in the park, and they talked until dark. till the moon was aglow in the trees. Then he took a hand and got down on his knees. I've got two questions to ask, if you please. Would you consider becoming my wife? We both know I'm not a young pup. When she said yes, now what's the next question? He said, would you help me get up? It was old love, old love, so long ago, and yet through the time and the tears and the passage of years, some things a heart won't forget. No, some things a heart can't forget.
Okay, so I'm sitting here with my very, very, very dearest friend, Michelle Brauerman.
Who's rattling papers,
right?
Because I take notes on everything.
You're going to take notes on the interview?
I don't know. I always write things down.
Okay, good. All right, good.
It's my coping mechanism.
So, and I told Michelle that I want to do a series of interviews on the anatomy of the artist, what it takes to be an artist, to try and make a living as an artist in our culture. And I wanted to talk to her about it because I can't think of anybody who has done so much and struggled so much and keeps doing it over and over again in every conceivable area of her life. So I'm going to open it. I don't have an agenda for this interview. I don't have questions. But maybe we could start with you talking about just giving us a sort of overview of your career, how it started, what you thought you wanted to do, some of the things that you did, all of them if you can remember.
Okay. I started off as a child writing songs and singing and playing the piano.
Child being?
Oh, I was playing and singing by the time I was 3 and making up songs by the time I was 5.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was just there. It was just a part of me. I remember going to National Music Camp in Interlochen, Michigan, which was extraordinary. And when I was 11 and, you know, supposedly in like junior division, but taking like upper division composition classes there and writing little tunes that I look back on with like kind of embarrassment because they were childish, but I was a child. And by the time I was 13, I was like writing. I found my first songwriting partner. I could write music, but not lyrics. And there was a girl in my high school named Iris Ratner, and I accosted her in the girls' locker room and said, "You're Iris Ratner." And she said, "Yes," fearfully. And I said, "You write lyrics?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "I write music." She was 3 years older than me. We started writing songs together. Mm-hmm. And that she's Iris Raynor Dart, who wrote Beaches, the novel, and many other very famous novels, and wrote for television. She's my first songwriting partner. And then I went to Northwestern University, and I have a degree in music composition from Northwestern, which was a kind of an odd thing. I was the only female composition major in that undergraduate school, and that undergraduate department was not even a tenth of what I expected and hoped it would be, which is sad. I learned a lot. I learned mostly in theory and analysis and other areas, but the composition department was dreadful.
Why?
There were only two teachers there. The first that I had, sophomore year, I remember him saying to me at one point early on in the year, "My dear, this is the 21st century. We don't write melodies anymore."
You're kidding.
No, and melodies is what I do best. And then the guy who was the head of the department the next year was just, I just don't feel that he ever taught anything. I don't remember either of them really teaching me anything about the architecture of music, the structure of music, how just a piece was assembled, let alone how to give it depth or beauty or meaning or unity or anything, you know. I mean, they were just, I just remember them as people who taught nothing to me.
Wow.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
I graduated in 3 years instead of 4. That was good. I got out of there. And then I spent a couple of years in Chicago playing in bars, playing first like in piano bars and then in jazz clubs with trios and quartets and learning how to play with the group and playing what we now call, currently call the Great American Songbook. But I wasn't writing anything. I came out of that school just broken. And I was also, but I also went back and did graduate studies there. I was just sort of, you know, treading water, I think.
I want to stop you. Did you have a, did you know what you wanted?
I grew up thinking that I wanted to write music and sing and perform it. But I grew up with this weird sense of, but what my mission was supposed to be, of what I thought I had to do, which was somehow to be a cross between Stravinsky and Streisand. And that anything less than that, I couldn't justify being on the earth.
Good grief.
That was what I felt was my obligation. So I obviously failed.
No.
I'm not Stravinsky and I'm not Streisand. I haven't had either of those careers, so I didn't do it.
So that's so interesting because I know who you are, and who you are is so special, so unique. Maybe you won't be able to accept this, but it seems to me that you are more than both of them right now. I mean, Stravinsky didn't sing, and Streisand didn't compose.
But they both were world famous and have left a huge mark, and I think that was part of what I also felt was that the mission that I was supposed to fulfill. I've left a mark, though. I mean, I've written a lot of music that a lot of children have heard, that's for sure.
Oh, tell about that.
Okay, I stumbled into this, but I was asked to write songs for a sequel to the Land Before Time movie, and that was in 1994. So I co-wrote songs for that sequel with Amanda McBroom, and they liked our work on that so much that they asked us to do another and then another and then another one. And up until till now, I think we've written... co-written songs for 15 or 16 animated features for children. Mm-hmm. And I also became the producers of those songs. And they include, I think it's like 9 or 10 sequels to Land Before Time, American Tale 4, Hercules and Xena, the animated feature, Chipmunks Meet Frankenstein, one of my proudest moments, and two Balto sequels, and Br'er Rabbit. So I've done a lot of music for kids. And right now, oddly enough, Amanda and I are writing a musical, which we're going to be doing a production of at Northwestern University, where mm-hmm. I went to school. And a lot of the students that are in it grew up watching The Land Before Time.
Well, I want to back up to the idea of leaving a mark and how that, not only for you, but for so many of us, is a driving force, and that it seems to exist in tandem with the work that we want to do.
Well, I think it's probably two things. I mean, there may be something genuinely about it there may be some real reason that should be a drive, but I think there's a lot of factors. First of all, we live in a society that emphasizes celebrity so badly. I mean, I've done really good work that I'm proud of. It's been heard a lot. They've sold millions of videos. I don't know if that's what I want on my headstone, but I'm a working composer in a world where that almost doesn't exist, where in the entertainment industry, to a huge extent, there's only two ways you can go. You can just struggle and scrape and not survive, or you become phenomenally successful. I live in that area in between. There aren't that many people that I know of that do, although I think there's more than I'm aware of because you wouldn't necessarily be aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a working musician. I've made a living, supported myself and my children when I had to. As a composer and producer.
And also... although it may not be the primary way you want to be remembered, as an accompanist, as a music teacher, as a voice teacher, as a,
musical director.
As a musical director.
And arranger, yeah. And I've come to value that, too. For a long time, I devalued it. I devalued it was because something I did as a child without even trying. It was effortless. And it wasn't an ambition I had. I certainly had no ambitions about being an accompanist. That was like a, to me, almost a demeaning situation, oddly enough. And it just had to do with the way I was used as a child, as the accompanist to my parents or my sisters or anyone else who wanted to sing. It was, it felt demeaning because I didn't feel that it was a choice. And so I carried that for a long, long, long time. I don't carry that so much anymore. I have realized that I love accompanying a great singer. And that I, it's like putting my hands under somebody, and it's actually a wonderful thing to be able to do. I like it, and I do it really well, and I thoroughly enjoy it. And then I even would go so far as to say that part of me feels a lot safer doing that than I do if I'm like in front singing and playing.
Well, that brings up the issue of the dichotomy for all people who try and make their living in the creative arts. If you're, I worked with a lot of people who wanted to be writers, wanted to be artists, fine artists, who wound up working in advertising,
mm-hmm.
because that was the only place that would pay for those skills. It isn't what they wanted to do.
Right.
Because they fell in love with words or they fell in love with pictures, but this was the only place in our culture that allowed them to make a living.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to do something. The world is such that we have to do something, to pay our way. Unless somebody else pays for us, which I would have found unacceptable, even if I had been offered it, I think. In fact, I think, looking back, I did my best to steer clear of any situation where that might have been at all possible. Along with steering clear of probably a lot of people who might have helped me in other ways. I just did a really good job of avoiding that.
Well, and again, I don't think that's so uncommon. The idea, so many artists, I think, get the idea that we pretty much have to do it ourselves because there's so little support, really, in this culture for artists. You either are, as you say, a celebrity and then everybody wants a piece of you, or they want to know what you do for a living, what your gig is, what your job is, because this stuff isn't serious somehow.
Right. And it's funny, too, Lynn, when I'm putting this in quotes, working at what I do, it's not work. It's not work. They talk about playing an instrument, and playing is the operative word. When I'm working on a project creatively, it's like playing dress-up when I was a child. It's using my imagination. It's playing these great games of what if. We were at Northwestern a few weeks ago for a casting, weekend of casting and meetings, and the costumer came in with the designs for our show. Oh, my God, you should have seen. So gorgeous, and I started to cry. I mean, the idea that this thing that we're making with our imaginations is going to be actually a real thing on a stage with people in costumes on a set and movement, and it's thrilling. It's thrilling. I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's we don't live in a culture that has value for what you just described, and I think that is all really that's of value.
I think we're living in an Orwellian culture. If you go back and read Brave New World, read the first four chapters, there's a sequence in there that is so powerful, where these babies who are all raised, in petri dishes and incubators, and now they're like little infants who are crawling, and they're showing a visitor around the incubation center, and they put all the babies in this big, huge room, like a big gymnasium with a shiny, beautiful wood floor. All the babies are on this shiny floor, all in a line. And at the far end of the room, people come in and they bring red roses, and they set them in a line at the other end of the room. And all the babies get very excited, and they immediately start crawling across the floor to get to the red roses. Third of the way across the floor, an electrical shock goes off and shocks all the babies. they are being conditioned to not respond to nature or to beauty.
Or to beauty, that's it.
Because beauty and nature are not necessarily packageable and saleable commodities, and the economy in that world is based on everything being packaged and sold. And if people learn to be content with beauty or relationships or art or process, gee, there's not money to be made in that.
This reminds me of two things. Shirley MacLaine's trip to China, I believe I'm correct in saying she took the very first delegation of women to China after it was opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to an art factory where people were turning out art. And they were turning out the same thing over and over again. And she apparently said to the person who was running it, so what happens if you have Michelangelo here? What do you do with him? And the guy said, oh, well, we re-educate him. And it's that same thing. You know, it's not useful. We don't value it.
Right.
And in this culture, it's not quite that bad. But we only value it if it makes a lot of money.
We only value it if it makes a lot of money. And even that's relative. I once remember having a conversation with my dad about this where I said, look, if Madonna and Vladimir Horowitz were both arriving at the airport, where do you think the reporters would be?
Right.
And the crowds. They would not be meeting the plane with Vladimir Horowitz on it, I guarantee you.
No, I'm sure that's right.
But
so the dilemma for a person who comes into life as early as you did, in love with music, or drawing, or dance, or, you know, whatever it is that you find, you know, just captures you, and when you're doing it, time passes without you knowing it, and you're immersed, and it is your life, it's what, you know. So for people like you and me, there is not really a path.
Well, there are some pathways that some artists have trod and done very well. I mean, I remember going around, I was looking for a record deal in the early 70s in New York, you know, and meeting all these A&R people, some of whom really loved what I was doing and some of whom said, well, I don't see a market for this. But no matter what, most of them had this philosophy. I remember was that one of them put it, you know, the cream always rises. In other words, if what you do is good enough, you will wind up, you know, successful. I'm sorry.
Really?
That is just such a crock.
That's right.
There are so many creamy people who are walking around who have not been heard or seen or recognized. That's just a crock. But you buy it. You think, oh, that's true. So it's like social Darwinism backwards. You think, if I haven't been successful, I must not be very good.
Right.
And it takes a long, long time. It took me a long, long time before I was able to say, no, wait a minute. You know, I listen to a lot of songs, and I know the good ones. I feel it in my body. And I think I can even recognize my good ones. And I think I have a lot of good songs. I can feel them in my body. Marketable, maybe, maybe not. And maybe that has more to do with the rest of my personality and my ability to market myself. I mean, Madonna is a genius of marketing. I don't know if she's a genius talent, but she's a genius of marketing. And she is a talent, and she is creative. I'm not trying to denigrate her in any way, but, you know, that woman is not afraid. Her sense of entitlement is staggering.
Yeah.
And
I think it is.
Picasso was a genius of marketing, by the way.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, I think, is the point you're making.
Right, right,
right. The talent for the talent and the talent for the marketing can exist in the same person.
They can, but they don't often. And then you see people who, you know, well, you see people who are really successful who think that they're not. Look at Joni Mitchell. She thinks she's having a terrible career. I don't believe it, but she does.
How do you know that?
I heard her talk about it in interviews and things. I've heard other people talk about it. She has just this awful attitude that the world isn't giving her the recognition she deserves.
Well, and then there's Janice Ian, who actually I heard say in an interview that I heard her repeat that myth that an artist must suffer.
Yeah.
And if you're not suffering, you're not an artist.
Does she believe that?
Apparently. I heard her say it in an interview.
Oh, Jesus.
Right, exactly. So,
All right. You know, if you're not making art, you're not an artist. Well, that's kind of like if you're not creating something, you may be a potential artist, but you're not an artist. If you're creating art, you're an artist. I don't care if you're suffering or not. That's not the definition.
No, I agree. But I think the point that we're making is that there are so many myths about what it takes, what you have to be, and whether it's going to, you know. And really, that none of them are true. Right. None of them are true. It's, you know, every possible route to success, however impossible, you know, it is to conceive of that, has been made. And then there are hundreds of people who have done what they were supposed to do, all the things they were supposed to do, and it didn't work.
And there are thousands of people who set out with tremendous dreams and tremendous talents who are now, you know, doing carpentry somewhere or selling real estate.
Yeah,
or
what's the line from, do you know the way to San Jose, washing cars and pumping gas?
Yeah. Well, that, or doing other things that are meaningful, not necessarily washing cars
and pumping gas, not necessarily
waiting tables, but who have built other careers, you know, have just gone on and said, geez, that's not my path.
Right.
And the talent is still there and dormant, you know, or being exercised in other ways.
Yeah, it seems to me, because I have worked only with writers and artists for a very long time, seeing the pain of not being able to do the thing, you know, missing it.
Or not being able to sell the thing.
Or not being able
You can
to
do
sell.
The thing. I mean, you know, really, nobody can stop you from sitting down with your piano or your guitar
That's
or whatever,
right.
writing a song, or getting your brush out and painting, or sitting at your computer and writing a novel. Nobody can stop you from doing that.
And that, it seems to me, is the most important thing either one of us has said today, to value the thing and not to surrender it because you can't make a living at it.
Right, yeah, don't buy into this doesn't have value because it's not earning money. Just don't buy into it. It's not true. It may have enormous value. Mozart was buried in a pauper's grave, you know, in a common grave, in a pit with 100 other bodies. And he was Mozart. That's the point, is you don't know that you're Shakespeare when you're doing it. You don't know.
And it's not about
Mozart
that.
Knew he was gifted. Mozart knew that his music flowed from some source. He knew it was beautiful. I bet he knew it in his body, you know, just the way I think I know things in my body.
Mm-hmm.
But he received very, very little acknowledgement. Here's an interesting story about Mozart. Mozart was invited to go to Prague. He was living in Vienna, and Vienna was like, it was like New York, New York, you know, if you can't make it in Vienna, it just doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But people in Prague loved his music, and he was invited to go to Prague at one point, and he got there, and people were like in the streets, lined up in throngs, greeting him by singing his music in the streets as he drove past. They loved him in Prague. Did he stay there? He did not. He did not. He didn't think that it was meaningful because it wasn't Vienna, and he went back to Vienna to continue struggling.
And there it is, again.
Yeah, what does that say?
Well, I mean, it could say a whole lot of stuff. And the real question for each of us, I think, is if you have an artistic passion, can it be enough for you?
You know, and I think the answer to that is, well, yes and no. Because it's hard to keep making art in a vacuum, A. B, you know the joke, if Helen Keller fell down in the forest and nobody was around, would she make a sound? If you're writing songs and nobody hears them, what does that feel like? If I'm writing musical theater, it needs to be in a theater. It needs to be collaborated on. I need, you know, an entire creative team, including producers in the theater and backers and investors and directors, choreographers, actors, musicians.
Customers.
I mean, in order to see to fulfill that particular thing, you know, otherwise, as I was quoting Marshall Barer, who used to say, the Hollywood Hills are alive with the sound of unpublished songs from unproduced musicals.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise, like, what... I mean, you can stack your manuscripts in the barn like Charles Ives did. He knew that nobody really wanted to hear what he was writing at that point in time, and he still needed to write it. So he invented life insurance and then sold life insurance so that he could support himself very well, and he continued to write his music, and he literally just, you know, would finish a piece and he put the manuscript in the barn, that place where he kept his music.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he was okay with it.
Well, and... Well,
or maybe not.
Was it Dickens who worked as a clock all day and wrote all night?
No, I think Dickens actually wrote, you know, he wrote
his... So who was it? One of them, one of the English writers.
Maybe.
Worked all day, wrote all night. But again, this is the dilemma of the artist in our culture. If you are not making a living at your work,
what do you do?
What do you do?
How do you manage? How do you find the energy?
No, and that
brings
us...
How do you find the energy and time to continue to do what you need to do and support yourself, and God forbid, support a family?
And that's...
Or if you're lucky, support a family.
No, exactly. And I want to say, because this is particularly... Well, I don't know, maybe it isn't. I want to say this is a dilemma for women who have children.
It's a dilemma for women who have children, but it's a dilemma for men, too, who feel that incumbent upon them, they have to be able to support a family. I saw that just slam into my ex-husband, my first husband, because his passion was writing music and performing his music. And he didn't see a way, given the skill sets that he had, he didn't see a way that he could do that and, you know, support himself, let alone a partner or kids. And that really cost him. That cost him a huge chunk of his spirit.
Yes, and I think it costs however you do it, you know?
It costs however you do it, but I mean, I sort of made choices. I just said I'd rather live more simply. I'd rather do with less. I'd rather buy my freedom to continue to do what I love to do. And I'm willing to live, you know, fairly frugally in order to do that.
Well, and also...
And I also, though, been lucky to have partners who had some money coming in, too, so that made it easy for me to say that. You know?
Well, and you did these other things that you didn't particularly want to do.
Yes, I did.
You know?
And actually, most of those things have wound up being the things that opened doors, because if I'd been able to just stay home in my own house, in my sweats, you know, writing music, I wouldn't have found the avenues that I've found for the work that I've created, so... oddly enough, the things that I didn't want to do that I was doing with some reluctance or even embarrassment have been the greatest gifts that opened other doors. I was accompanying Amanda McBroom at the old Blah Blah Cafe, which has been a great boon to both of us. I can't even tell you how many different ways. But at that point, Dixie Carter, who knew Amanda, came in and saw what I was doing with Amanda and called me and asked me to work with her. So I worked with Dixie as a musical director. And later, when she started to do well with Designing Women and wanted to do a yoga video, she had me score the yoga video, which wound up being at Universal, which is why I got the job doing the Land Before Time movies. So look at those steps, you know? I mean, I guess if I've learned something because of that, it's take all your steps and keep your eyes open to all the windows that are around you.
Yeah.
And one thing for an artist that you maybe don't want to do is hide in your house and, you know, just write your music or paint your paintings. You've got to have some avenues that pull you into the world, even if they don't look, I'm sort of thinking out loud here, but even if they don't look like the avenues you had in mind, all those doors are windows, or all those windows are doors, or something like that. They're there. They're there. And, you know, one way or another, you find out ways, you find ways of meeting other people or being heard.
I think that's a very good place for us to stop. Thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you, Lynn. That was fun.
And it was fun. And not only because I love Michelle and she is continually interesting for me, but because talking to artists, people who have dedicated their life to some self-expression, is fun. It's fun to be in the presence of someone who is who they are. And I hope that you also hear that and experience it. And of course I have so much more to say about this, but I'm not going to say it now, because I want to play the last two songs from Michelle's album, which is called Fools and Little Children. And I need to say that you can get access to me and also find out about Michelle, where she's playing, what she's doing, how to get her CD, by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave out the E, S-H-O-W, thelynshow.com. Click on Email Me. Ask me, where is Michelle playing? How can I get her CD? How can I find out more about her? Or anything else you want to ask me up there. But I want to play these last two songs, which I've chosen because they speak to the dilemma of being a woman in our culture. And they have two, I think, from my point of view anyway, very different ways of looking at it, both of which are quite right, I believe, quite real. And I'm not going to say any more. I'll let you make your decisions for yourself. So the first one is The Ballad of Robin and Marian, and the second one is Aurora. And here, again, Michelle Brauerman.
Marian escaped to Sherwood every chance she got to rally with the men in Lincoln Green. Nottingham was rotten and she was simply not the kind of fancy waiting on the Queen. She'd saddle up her mare, ride like the wind, feel the mist of Sherwood burn against her skin, longing for the day when Richard ruled again and Robin could ride free beneath the sky. Why women learn to smile and curtsy and pretend to be afraid. She wanted bows and arrows and lessons with a sword. She hated every time they called her maid. She'd fasten up her skirts to practice her skills, mastering her courage, strengthening her will. She would fight beside him, she would even kill, so Robin could ride free beneath the sky. Hey, 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 hey. Richard got his ransom paid and came claim his throne. Robin got a title and estate. He married Lady Marian with the blessings of the crown, then rode away on Richard's last crusade. And Marian would pace the grey castle halls, staring at the tapestries she hung upon the walls, knowing she was saddled with a lady's protocol, while Robin could ride free beneath the sky. And oh, how she yearned to gallop through the night and carry desperate warnings and take chances with her life and see her outlaw spirit in the mirror of his eyes and once again ride free beneath the sky. Safe behind my wall of thorns, Moon's a princess under glass. Until I felt a trembling, sweet honey on my lips, fluttering me open, waking by the wonder of a kiss. Are you the one they promised would come for me one day? Sweep me up behind you and carry me away. Are you the fabled perfect prince, the future they foretold? Oh, lady, no, he backed away. I would not be so bold.
Think of a more appropriate song for my show? I cannot. It is At Last Awake that I am wishing for all of us. And so let me say, as I always do at the end of the show, a huge thank you to Josh Hackney, my IT recording electronics guru, and tell you that if you go up on my website, you can find him. And say, as I always do, that I hope that you heard something you can use in this show. Something that you knew but had forgotten. Something you didn't know. Something that touched your curiosity, your heart, your intellect. Something that just entertained you. Because I hope that you heard something that will bring you back. As next week, I will be here. Same time, same station. And boy, I hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Thank you.
that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let me.